Hey, it's Evan Pagan. I'm interviewing one of my favorite business minds today. His name is Brad Fallon. He's a good friend. He's someone that I've just gotten to know over the last couple of years here. He's the chairman of a company called Smart Marketing, and he's also the president of a company called StomperNet. And the thing that makes that interesting and unusual is that Smart Marketing is an offline company that, you know, does brick and mortar and sell stuff. They actually sell a lot of stuff online, but they sell hard, tangible goods. And that company does $20 million a year plus. And he's also the president and the creator, co-creator of the StomperNet program, which teaches internet marketing, SEO, how to build a business online. And they had the biggest launch in internet history. So he's a creator, an implementer, and he's also a teacher. And he and his partner, Andy, also created a company called FreeIQ, which is kind of like, in a way, the YouTube, but for business, for info products, for e-commerce, for affiliate marketing, for video. And they've gotten tens of thousands of people over there to sign up as affiliate partners. And I don't know all the numbers, but I know that these guys are growing some really amazing businesses. And I got Brad, talked him into doing an interview with me. So welcome, Brad.
Hey, it's great to be here, Evan.
So let's talk a little bit. Every time you and I have a conversation, I mean, we were supposed to start this interview an hour ago, and we've been showing each other videos online and catching up on, you know, robotics and artificial intelligence. And
dude, check this out.
Exactly. I think that some of our most interesting conversations have been about growing businesses, of course. It's what fascinates both of us. And right before we started here, I said, you know, what are your favorite topics? And like me, you said, well, you know, I get interested in something for a while and I really get into it, and that's what's most interesting to me. And then I want to go learn about another one because there's a bigger picture. We're always looking for a bigger picture. So I thought what would be interesting as a format here is, you know, in the Altitude program, I break up growing a business into five areas. You, your market, your marketing, your people, your systems. And I thought maybe we could just cruise through these and get some of your thoughts on each of them. You know, when it comes to entrepreneurs growing businesses, what are some of the things that, you know, a lot of them don't realize? I mean, I love some of your stuff on, you know, growth businesses and the economy and so forth. Can you maybe just enlighten us on some of the things that the average entrepreneur doesn't know about how special they are?
Well, sure. I think that to answer the question of what it is that a lot of people don't know, I think that's an important question. And it's something I've actually been thinking about quite a bit lately, where we kind of look at business in stages and levels. And we're always trying to figure out how to get to the next level. And I don't think that for younger business owners, I'm not sure that they always realize that. Most of us spend an awful lot of time trying to get good at what we're doing. And we try to get better and better and better at doing what we do. And the problem is that most of us don't spend near enough time just trying to figure out what is the next level and what we need to know when we get there to maximize that, and of course what we need to learn to be able to get there faster. So I think that, but as people go up to the higher and higher levels, you begin to sort of recognize the pattern. And the pattern is that you're going up. And as you say, as you rise, then you gain altitude, if you will. And so the higher the level or the ladder, the stage that you're at, you tend to have a better perspective and begin to realize that. And so in the earlier stages, I think that is probably the most common thing that people don't know, is that it doesn't matter what they're doing. They think they're being productive. They think they're learning to get good at what they're doing, but that's not what's important. What's important is to spend more time just trying to figure out what is next and what questions you need to be able to ask to get there.
Hmm. Yeah. Sometimes I, when I'm in the middle of trying to start a new project or do something and it's tough and, you know, I'm having a hard time getting it rolling or there's some challenge or, you know, weirdness with it, I reflect back on my life and on the different stages I've gone through in business, and I realize that anytime I felt like I was trying to put another big piece of the puzzle together in business, what I was really doing was just putting together one of the pieces. I was working on the corner of one of the pieces of the puzzle, and that it's really about continuing to discover and continuing to learn and continuing to realize that wherever you're at right now, there are many levels beyond. So don't get too caught up in it. You know, don't get too hung up.
I like to quote myself a lot.
Fantastic.
Only because I do try to spend time. You mentioned my partner Andy, and Andy and I are just a great yin and yang, because he's really good at like taking a sentence and talking for an hour and really just developing content around an idea. And I've always been pretty good at hearing a bunch of stuff and trying to crystallize it down to like, you know, what's the important point. And so I do spend a lot of time trying to take ideas and get them down to pithy quotes or you know, whatever, just thinking about how do you explain a concept very short, quickly, so that someone can understand. But all that to say, here's a quote that I like. If you're doing something you're good at, that's probably bad.
Hmm. Explain that a little bit. Pretend you're Andy.
No, I'm done. That's my sentence, and my job's over.
Interview's finished.
I think that's the thing. I, for example, am in a CEO group with a lot of guys that we get to, and I've been in for almost a few years now. Vistage is the largest CEO member organization in the world. It's kind of like a YPO or something like that. If people haven't heard of it, they have about 15,000 members in 15 countries, And we get together in groups of 15 or so. There's about 40 groups in Atlanta, and I'm in a group now for a few years. And most of the guys that are in my group are older than me. Most of them are in their 50s, some in their 60s. And most of them have been running their business for 20 or 30 years. So I've had a chance to really observe this over the last 3 years, that they just have been doing the same thing for 20 years. And that seems foreign to me. It seems strange to me. I've never been able to hold down a job for 2 years in my whole life. And to be able to do something like that for 20 years is just amazing. But they've really, it's been the same thing. So some of the guys and what they do, the restaurants they run, the CPA firm that they manage, the law firm that they're a partner in, the construction company they own. I mean, it's literally pretty much the same job today that it was, 10 years ago and 15 years ago. And things have changed in, technology or whatever, but they're just really doing the same thing. And if you really want to grow faster, which is, you and I have talked, is one of our favorite things to talk about, and certainly one of my favorite things to think about, is not just how do you get from point A to point B, but how do you do it faster? And the fact is, if you want to get to the next level or the next stage that we're talking about, it's going to require different skills than it took to get there to this level that you're already at. So if you're doing something really at the next level, in the next stage, you're going to be a rookie. It's going to be something you've never done before, and you shouldn't really expect to be that great at it. You just have to embrace the challenge, embrace the fact that you're learning, appreciate that, and not get bent out of shape about being a rookie, and realize that if you're growing quickly, you're always going to be working on new stuff. And so if you find that you're just doing the same thing over and over and over, and you've gotten really good at it, you're probably not pushing yourself to the next level as much as you could.
It's a great point, Brad. Well, first of all, it's just, it almost seems obvious once you've heard it, but it's going to require a different set of skills to get to the next level than whatever it took to get you here. And, again, it's kind of back to that, what I was just talking about there, that what you're learning right now is a piece of a much bigger puzzle, as long as you see it that way, as long as you think about continuing to grow and continuing to go to the next level. I did an interview recently with Mike Littman, and he was asking some different questions. And one of the things I realized during the interview, I think he may have talked about this directly, but just remembered, people that are really successful tend to be able to become successful, and maybe they lose it all or something unfortunate happens. They get it back. They lose it again. I've even heard quotes or statistics that sometimes, the average multimillionaire has lost it a couple of times and then gotten it back. Whereas people that aren't successful, they never can get it in the first place. And so being more concerned with the learning so that you have the skill, I mean, you or I at this point in our lives, if something happened, if it was an unfortunate event happened and we lost it all, because of our networks and because of our, kind of knowledge and what we know about things, we could go and rebuild a business pretty rapidly. So understanding all the skills is important.
For sure. And I think, really two things. One, my first business was the summer after I graduated from high school. I gave my valedictorian speech on Friday afternoon, and on Monday I was in sales training in Nashville to go sell books door to door 80 hours a week and for the summer. And I did that for 4 summers. And then my first job after college was my own business. And I had probably 3 or 4 people working for me 3 or 4 months after I graduated. But I didn't know anything about business. I just knew about sales. And of course, that's not enough, but I didn't know it. I didn't understand the importance of mentors. I got bad advice. And I've really been banging my head against the entrepreneurial wall for 20 years, literally. I'm 40 now. I just turned 40 and I started 18. So over 20 years, I've been banging my head against that wall. And it was really, it made me think, and I've definitely had failures along the way, probably more than successes, some interesting successes, but sometimes they didn't last or whatever. But I've always had an inordinate tolerance for risk that I think is really born by the fact that, like, for example, when we sold books, we would go across the country and get others to come with us. And we didn't even know what state we were going to be in until the afternoon when we left from Nashville and sales school to go there. So once you've sort of gone out there a lot and gone back and gone back and gone back, you sort of realize that you kind of don't have a big fear of the unknown. And it's really fear of the unknown that prevents a lot of people from doing a lot of things, even hiring new people. I see it all the time where it's not that they don't have the skills to interview or something, but they just sort of, they're comfortable with what they have. And you know that people will put up with horrible situations just because they know it. It's the bad thing that you know versus some unknown thing. And even you think, just be logical. Whatever it would be, it can't be worse than this. But people will stay because they know it. And the fear of the unknown is really a significant thing. Most people have not had the opportunities to go out there and try to make payroll and learn how to bootstrap and realize that if you lose it, you can go get it back. And so if you haven't had those experiences, it's kind of natural for people to just put up with their comfort zone. Where I've sort of come to realize that I think my role in life is to try to drag people out of their comfort zones and just say, look, you know, let's don't look around and think that we're great. Look at all these other people up here. There's a lot more here. And yeah, let's celebrate here for, you know, a good week or a good year or whatever. But gosh, you know, we're not neat. Look at those guys. They're neat. And we got a lot of work to do. And let's figure that out.
Mm. So speaking of mentors, how can an entrepreneur get mentors and why are they important?
Yeah, that's a great topic. Let me just say one other thing, that whole idea about fear of the unknown and the characteristic of entrepreneurs, I think it has to do with sort of a tolerance for risk and just a willingness to kind of go for it because you're not, you know what, if it doesn't work out, you can try again and it's not going to be the end of the world if that doesn't work. You go ahead and not being too afraid of what might happen if it doesn't work. Some people would say that that's, you know, risk tolerance and not being risk averse, but it's really just knowing that it's okay to try. And if you fail, it's not that bad. The only thing that's bad if you stop trying. So I know that's really trite, but I mean, that's kind of that principle. So that was one. The other thing is that we spend all this time trying to get good at what we're doing in that topic. I wanted to mention that I think that it's like email. And the problem with email, we all know what a time suck it can be and whatever, but if you think about email and why, what's really bad about it is that if you're sitting there doing your email, you feel productive. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so that we all run that problem where we can go a whole day and not even answer any emails or what, you're better at this than me. You never even answer my email. No, I'm just kidding. But I mean, you know, we can go a day or two and not even answer emails and look back and go, oh, you know, whatever. I didn't reply to that newsletter. I didn't, you know, whatever. Or we can go ahead and open up our email and start going through them, and we start answering these emails, forwarding things, replying to things, letting people know things, and we feel like we're being productive. And it's not because the opportunity cost of what else we could be doing is just huge, but we don't realize it because we feel productive. And that's what happens when people spend almost all of their time trying to get good at the level that they're at and not spending more time trying to figure out what is next.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to come back to that one in a second here. Talk to me a little bit about mentors, because
sure.
You brought it up and we don't talk enough about it. How do you find mentors? Why are they important?
Well, so step one is to realize that they are really, really important. And this was kind of the path that I went through where I was fortunate to be raised in a great family. My folks are both teachers. They didn't know a lot about making money. But, you know, they were really into education and, you know, they had two kids and we were both valedictorians in high school. So they sort of did their job, if you know what I mean. And and they were just, you know, really into, you know, the Kool-Aid mom on the block and, the Cub Scout leader and all that kind of stuff. So I was fortunate to be raised in a great family. But when I got out to bid, my folks both worked for the government. They were teachers. They had, just salary jobs. And I remember one time when I was small, I asked my dad, I said, hey, Dad, why don't you... you know, why don't you go start your own business? Why don't you go work for yourself? And he said, son, when you work for yourself, when you have your own business, you don't work for yourself. You work for everybody. And that was his perspective. That wasn't a great thing to do. And so I didn't get it at home. And then I went to a pretty good college and was sort of there with, I'd gone from lived in mostly small towns and went from kind of a small town high school to a pretty good college in a big city. And there with rich kids from all over the country who came from mostly, you know, with real successful business-wise parents. And just thought, you know, how does this work? What's the deal? And I just never really realized that. I thought if you went out and worked hard and applied yourself, that would sort of be enough. And it wasn't until literally 15 years later that I started to figure out that, you know what, there is another level, and banging at your head against the wall is not the way to do it. Figure out what you need to learn, figure out who already knows it, and ask them and learn from them. And so that's the idea of internships in colleges, and you know, people sort of understand this, but it's the idea of there's different kinds of mentors and there's different kinds of things where the idea is really just learning from people that have already been there and done that. And so mentors are one thing, masterminds are another thing, and you know, there's probably other things. There's books. So there's lots of different ways we learn, but mentors are definitely one of the key parts of it. And you know, I don't know that I've ever really, you know, done that well at getting a mentor to, you know, have me over to their house and, you know, have breakfast with them once a week or once a month and, hey, what's going on, and keep up with that. What I find is really more important, more practicable, more valuable, and more realistic is to find sort of, you know, short-term mentors and mastermind groups. So, for example, if there's something you want to learn or something you don't try to get someone to spend an hour a month with you, you know, for the rest of your life. You try to find someone that knows something and then develop a relationship with someone that's just far ahead of you, usually older, usually wiser, usually wealthy, or someone that's just kind of been there before you that you can spend some time for. So sometimes when you say mentor, it just makes people think of a Santa Claus that's going to, you know, have you over to the house once a month for 10 years. And it's really not about that. It's more of about identifying experts and people that are really would be valuable to know from an educational standpoint and getting to know them to quickly learn. Because if you can get the time with someone like that, they've been through it. And if you start asking some questions, they can even help you figure out what the questions are. And in fact, that is a question. That's a key question. What are the questions I should be asking about this topic? Because the problem is, as you're going to the next level in business, the problem is you don't even know the questions to ask. Like when I go in and speak to groups of CEOs, usually 15 at a time or whatever, they're mostly older and a lot of them are very wealthy and they have great businesses, but they don't know anything about internet marketing. So I often come in to kind of talk about internet marketing and how they could apply some of these principles to their normal, regular, offline business. That was the book that I'd written a few years ago called, you know, Creating Customers Out of Thin Air, Secrets of Online Marketing for Offline Businesses. So I like to, you know, think about these principles that we've developed some deep expertise in and how to apply that to other people's regular businesses. So I come and talk about internet marketing, and it's exactly like that. If I walked into the room at the beginning of the presentation and says, okay, guys, I don't know everything, but I do know quite a bit about internet marketing, and what questions do you have about internet marketing? I can probably answer it. What do you want to know? Well, the problem is they don't even know what AdWords are. They've never heard of a sequential autoresponder. Two-thirds of them have never heard the phrase SEO. So they couldn't possibly know the questions to ask. So what I try to do is in a couple hours, you know, tell them that, you know, look, I'm not going to tell you the intricacies of how to set up an AdWords campaign, but I'm going to try to have you walk away from here. My goal is to have you at least know what the issues are, at least know what ballpark you're in. And so that can actually happen very quickly. If you're spending the time trying to figure out what's next and you can find someone that has deep expertise in that, if you can get them to spend a little bit of time with you, and that will be the second part of your question, is how do you actually do that? But if you can get them to spend a little bit of time with you asking questions, that they can do great things for you in a very short period of time without having to get up at 7 in the morning and go to breakfast every month.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would like to get you to answer the question that you predicted that I was going to ask. But also, I think it's critical to understand that a technique like understanding how to set up an autoresponder or how to do a little SEO or whatever does not a business make. And the stuff that those people know who have been doing it for 20 or 30 years is incredibly valuable. right? So what you know is valuable to them if you're hip to some area, especially internet marketing, and what they know is very valuable to you, and it can be a great little exchange.
That's right. And one of the neat things about finally getting some skills at internet marketing is that it really does apply to a lot of different things in business, and it's really core marketing stuff. So if you're trying to talk to a guy who actually has a business, oftentimes I find it's like a consultant, you know, or somebody that's really gone through the ringer in business and knows a ton, and they're not just running a business now, they're actually out consulting. And those guys are great because they're independent small business owners with information products, and you know we can add value to them pretty quickly.
That's great.
And that is the answer, by the way, and it's not something that I made up, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this are pretty familiar with this process. But if you want to get a hold of someone, you know, don't be the rookie. You're not calling up and asking for stuff. The whole goal is to see what value you can provide. And it's really two things. One is if you can sit down with them, they're in business and you know internet marketing, you can usually provide an awful lot of value to them. And so that's kind of a no-brainer. But the other thing is realize that people that have already sort of already circled the bases, if you will, people like that tend to be at a higher level. They tend to have perspective on everything. And those are the first people that like to not give back. That sounds trite. But they like to share with someone who's interested what they've learned and see if it couldn't help them too. People like to do that. They're not busy banging their head against the wall trying to earn a living. They're sort of beyond that. And those are the exact kind of people that love to share their knowledge, their experience with interested people. So if you show that you're interested, I guess one little specific tip is what you do. If you can get a hold of someone like that, and they're usually not that hard to get a hold of. Now, if you're trying to go get, you know, the CEO of a major corporation, that's great, and you'd love to, you're trying to just bug this guy and by email and get a hold of him, you know, a guy that's a CEO of a company is going to be pretty busy. But a guy that's an author, a guy that's already retired, a guy that's, you know, already been around the block, a guy that's a consultant, usually it's not that hard to get a hold of them. And then you just want to not overwhelm them at the beginning. But the best thing you can do is show some interest, ask a couple of good questions, not take all day, show very quickly and efficiently that you'd like to be able to add some value to them in a couple ways you might be able to do it. And then when they give you some advice, the secret is to go do that. Because everything I've said so far is true. Those kind of people love to share their knowledge, love to share their experience, love it to be helpful to someone else. But all kinds of people always ask them for advice, and most people listen politely, nod, and never go do a damn thing. If you'll go do what they said and then report back to them that you did it, that's the secret. Because if it works, they'll feel great and they'll probably be willing to give you more advice because you were one of the guys that actually listened and actually did something. And if it doesn't work, now they feel kind of responsible and they'll pull out all the stops to see if they can help you.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that is the ultimate compliment to someone who takes the time to teach you and share their advice is to actually go take action on it. And I've learned that over the years, having different mentors and different people in my masterminds and what have you, that when someone hits their stride in success, they don't really care how successful you are. If you are an interesting person to talk to, if you've got some value to add, if you're not just there to try to take something away from them, you can connect with just about anybody.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's not asking questions, say, tell me this, tell me this, tell me this. It's, here's what I'm thinking about. And you seem to have been down this road before. What do you think about this? And it's an interesting conversation for them to talk about what they're a subject matter expert in.
What are your best recommendations for becoming more productive and kind of managing yourself and your time in this new era that we're dealing with right now?
You mean as a business owner, as the manager, the top manager of a business?
Yeah, as an entrepreneur.
Sure. Well, the first thing is stop doing things, right? And so the short answer is just stop doing things. And that's really tough for most people because in my experience, which is not a large experience of really hanging around people, but I've spent now a few years in a very, you know, sort of intimate setting with guys have been running companies for 20 and 30 years and you know, do 20, 30, 40, $50 million a year. And then just like, you know, you and I out kind of talking to people that have businesses. I've been around it for a while now. And in my experience, most of the companies that are run by the entrepreneur that started them, in almost every case, if that entrepreneur would literally fire themselves and get someone else in there to run. And I don't mean that they have to go and retire and live on an island or something like that, but they're literally doing stuff every day, managing the whole business that isn't really the important stuff to grow the business. One of the things that people need to read if they haven't read it is the book Blueprint to a Billion. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the reason that's such a great book is it's very data driven. I mean, you know, they looked at every company that went public since 1980 and looked at all the ones that got to $1 billion in revenue. Just only ones that went public since 1980 and ones that got to $1 billion. Now, some stayed there and some didn't or whatever, but they all got to $1 billion in revenue. And of those companies, they had 7 things in common. And so it's great to know what those things are. But the problem is that most of the entrepreneurs that are running their own company are trying to do both roles. And unfortunately, all of the companies that got to $1 billion in revenue had 2 people at the very top. One was doing that, running the company every day, tightening screws, making things more efficient, doing the procedure manuals, making sure we have systems for everything. And someone else was really, you know, full time on just trying to figure out what's next, just trying to figure out what's the innovation, what's the, you know, Peter Drucker always said that business is innovation and marketing, and working on that is completely different than tightening the screws on the ship you've already got.
That's great.
And so I find that when people are running their own company, I'm not saying that they're incompetent, but they just can't grow as fast because it's worthy of a full-time endeavor to be outward looking, talking to customers, talking to partners, talking to the market, feeling the market, seeing what's out there, being outside the company and innovating and figuring out what's next. That's mostly what I do full-time in our organizations. And I have partners, my wife in the first company and Andy in the second company that run the day-to-day stuff. And they, every time I bring them a new idea, they roll their eyes and say, you know, what are you talking about? We've got all these problems with the stuff we already have and get lost. But that's what they're doing all day, is doing a great job running the company, watching the ship, tightening the screws. And they do that full time while I'm kind of free to, you know, hang out with you on the phone and spend a couple hours talking about, what's going to happen in 2045.
Yeah, that's powerful. The idea of productivity being about stopping doing things, I think, is very counterintuitive for a lot of folks.
Yeah, and I hope that doesn't sound, you know, just, okay, great, nice advice. But, you know, it really is true. Here's a concrete example. Let me kind of put that in perspective. The idea in the organization is that it's not just you that needs to learn new things to get the higher level. The fact is, everybody in your organization needs to learn more things to have the organization develop, right? And so that's a very specific example of how do you get the organization to the next level. Well, it's the exact same thing as how you do it for a person. You've got to learn more stuff. Okay, well, how does an organization learn? Well, I don't know. How about training? Do you know how many small businesses or medium-sized businesses of $10, $20, $30 million where they have this company, everyone's busy, everyone's productive, everyone's doing everything all day, every day, and they spend like nothing on training? You know, they'll hire these people for, you know, $65,000, $75,000 a year salaries and not spend a couple of $100 to put them through an Excel course and teach them how to use Excel.
Yeah, it's so easy to not realize how much other people don't know. Once you learn something, it's like, you know, it's like you see a, I don't know, it's like a stereotypical, you know, person in an old movie who's prejudiced, who's, you know, an American person talking to an Asian person and shaking them down or something and saying, no, come on, you speak English, you know? It's like, we get this mindset when we become knowledgeable about a topic where we just think, oh, you know what, everybody knows that. And we don't know how valuable it would be to teach another person what we know, especially our organization.
But by the way, one tip that I would give is something that I do think is concrete and worth thinking about, is that if you want to learn faster yourself, you know, we talked about, you can get a mentor, you can get a mastermind group, you can read books, but really the fastest way to learn is to teach. And so that's what they do in medical schools. They call it see one, do one, teach one. That's how they learn a medical procedure. They watch it, then they do it, and then they teach it. And so I say all the time in our outfits, you know, see it, do it, teach it. And that is how you learn faster, because you can see something, but until you actually do it, you're definitely not going to have a chance. But you know what? You don't really understand it. You don't really have your arms around it until you can actually kind of crystallize it down and explain it to someone else. And so if you're constantly thinking about how you would explain it to someone else, that really helps you learn faster. And I think I was kind of sort of naturally wired that way, but I've always been kind of a seminar junkie. I've always liked going to seminars and taking notes, and you know, whether it was, you know, no money down real estate, or you know, options trading, or how to, you know, get rich quick, or whatever. I love and kind of going and learning new stuff that's about business or whatever, and taking notes and whatever. I like all that, but I've always sort of thought about, you know, okay, gosh, I was in this workshop for like 3 days. How you know, what are the important points here? And then you go back and explain it to someone else. So I was always kind of wired to do that. Well, it turns out that really is the fastest way to learn. And the reason I mention it as potentially a concrete example for helping your entire organization grow and develop faster in the same way that you want to, is that the guy at the top is often, you know, pontificating and telling everyone in the organization and teaching people and coaching people and stuff like that. But that's not the deal. The deal is how to get everyone in your organization teaching each other, teaching the new people, teaching whoever across departments, whatever. The more you can get everyone in your entire organization seeing stuff, doing stuff, and teaching the stuff, then that's better.
That idea right there is a profound little shift and an insight. In our world, we have a team training call once a week, and it used to be me training, and now we have other folks that participate and so forth. But that idea of asking yourself, how do you get every person in your organization teaching someone else? That's powerful.
Yeah, that's a good question. That is one of the keys. That's how you move everyone up much faster. So step one, spend more money on training, both time and money, because really the ROI that you get, bottom line, people that look at this kind of stuff and study it, the ROI that you get from training people how to use the damn software that they're using every day and be more efficient at it. You know, if people that don't do this, you'll be amazed what people that are making 45 grand a year will be doing and cutting and pasting. They didn't know that there was a button that does that, you know? And if you'll just make sure that everyone just gets trained on the software that they have, that gets trained on all these different things and put more money into training, you'll find that the ROI is unbelievable.
Yeah, I remember reading an article. Andy Grove did a kind of an exhaustive little study and figured out that the highest ROI investment that they had at Intel was training.
And you know what happens is that as entrepreneurs and as seminar junkies and as people that like to learn and grow, you know, most of us will put a decent chunk of our income back into our own education. And, you know, it's just a virtuous cycle or whatever. The more we make, the more we can spend on more expensive seminars from bigger and better gurus or whatever. We can have more time to read. We can do everything. But we tend to think about ourselves learning, and really, you know, we need to get off of that and figure out how we can get every single person in the company learning more.
All right. What about, let's move on to your market. Let's talk about niches and targeting markets and identifying good business opportunities. What are some of your best ideas on, you know, identifying a good niche or a good target market?
Let me answer it this way. I've been spending a lot of time lately thinking about, what questions do you ask yourself? You know, like a time study, right? Like what am I doing right now? Is this really the most important thing that I could be doing with my time? That's always a great question to ask. And, you know, it's really the questions that we ask ourselves that really drive everything. Because whether you know the answer quickly or it takes a while to figure it out, it's the questions that we ask ourselves that are really important. So I've been spending a lot of time lately just kind of thinking about what are the important questions and things like that. And one of the things that it sort of has occurred to me is that there's this kind of dichotomy between our market and what we're doing and the skills that it takes. And so, for example, in marketing, one of the things I always say is that we used to have a lot of niche websites. We do most of our marketing online. And now, as you say, we've gotten more into bricks and mortar, and you know, but like babiesrus.com is starting to sell our products, and Bed Bath and Beyond and things like that. But most of our business was always as an online e-commerce merchant, as selling physical products online, and all the traffic and conversion and things like that. Well, one of the things that we did early on is we said, well, we were so successful in selling wedding favors that we could also sell poker chips and electric scooters and cigars and wedding shoes and wedding rings. We had all these different e-commerce sites. And it took me about 2 years to kind of figure out that was just idiocy. It seemed smart at the time. I'm like, what we've done here, we can easily just, you know, with the same store and the same software and the same idea and the same traffic and the same conversion, we can do this in other markets. Well, it turns out that the hardest thing in marketing is really also the most important, and that's to really understand the customer. And it's just flat out hard to understand the customer and be really in tune in any one market, let alone half a dozen markets that are completely different. And so we decided to get rid of all those other extraneous sites and just focus on one thing. And so we've gone deep on favors. And so we do wholesale favors and we supply all of our competition. And that's a great way to get deep. That's sort of a principle.
By the way, favors meaning wedding favors.
Yeah, party favors, like wedding favors, like little, you know, trinkets and tchotchkes that you give to everyone that comes to a wedding.
There you go.
Little chrome heart bottle stoppers, little place card holders, little wedding cake candles, things like that. And so we're now the largest supplier to all the in the industry, and you know that's a little niche. But you know there's a lot of ways that we could go deep. So now we do life event favors. So we do baby shower favors and bridal shower favors, and you know soon bar and bat mitzvah favors and quinceanera favors and all these different kinds of favors. So and wholesale and retail. And so we've decided to just kind of go deep like that. And so there's some lessons there in terms of like, well, you know, when do you do a brand extension, when do you not? I mean, those are the issues, but I'm not sure there's a huge lesson. But I would like to say that I think that what you can do is figure out what you need to do, and so figure out other ways to market what you do. I think that's something. Like if we're doing something that's successful, we think, well, I'll go do that. I'll go add another product. I'll extend my brand. I'll come up with another product in a related niche or the same niche or the niche above or the niche below, and I'll kind of do the same thing. And really, I encourage people to go a little bit more sideways and think about other ways that you could market. I'll just throw out a perfect example. Whatever you're doing, add information products. Right? If you sell information products, add physical products. If you, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's a lot of people that have e-commerce stores, and if they started selling some ebooks or some webinars or some courses or some, you know, teleclasses or email classes on what they do, they could make a lot more money with very high margin, and they don't think about it. They think, how can I go get another product, extend my brand, come up with a whole new company name, a whole new website name, a whole new thing, and just do what I'm doing now? Well, if they just did what they're doing now but found other things to sell in other formats to the exact same marketplace, they could probably do better. Another thing is like affiliate marketing. There's a lot of people that have great information products or great physical products that they sell, great online stores, or they are affiliates for that matter, and they don't have an affiliate program. So you need to kind of really make sure that you're maximizing all the different ways you can sell, all the different ways that you can market. There's people that are great at SEO that hardly do anything on pay-per-click. Well, that's crazy. There's people that do a ton on pay-per-click and don't do anything on SEO. Well, that doesn't make any sense. So figure out what are all the different ways and all the different formats that you can market to the customer that you already know. And I think that's a worthy question.
That's fantastic. And what about in terms of internet marketing right now? I know that you guys are going into the, you know, kind of the more modern social marketing and teaching a lot of this kind of stuff. What are some things that are coming over the horizon for us and things that are going to be real long-term marketing channels, avenues, methods that we're going to want to pay attention to in the future?
Sure. Well, I think a couple of the big themes are number one, social media marketing. You know, as you know, we do Stomper Smarts, and so we've got one of the larger training programs on teaching people how to take advantage of free traffic from Facebook and MySpace and YouTube and all these kind of things. Stomper Smarts stands for Social Marketing Traffic Strategies, and we're right in the middle of that program now. Another one of the big ones in that was Conversation Domination that Howie Schwartz did, and now Howie Schwartz is a full-time faculty member with StomperNet. So we're really kind of the leading company out there training people on and educating people on how to take advantage of all this free traffic. So that's definitely one thing that's big, and I'm sure people are listening and saying, oh, great, Brad, that's profound. Let me write that down. Facebook is big. Got that part. But you know, sometimes people don't really know how big it is. People think, well, it's kids or whatever. There's 1 million people a week that are 25 years of age or older signing up for Facebook. I mean, how is that not something we should be paying attention to?
Mm.
You know, 50 million unique visitors per month on YouTube. Do you know YouTube gets twice as many page views as Google does already? So it's a big thing. And so that's something to think about. But I would just encourage people to just, you know, note to self, yeah, it's a big deal. And yeah, we probably want to spend a little bit of time thinking about how stuff like that applies to our business. So the idea of social media marketing, social networks online.
Can you give me an example of how someone might get started in, you know, social networking, you know, marketing there? I tell people just go in there and go into one of the forums and just start a conversation with people. I mean, there are groups everywhere meeting on every possible problem and topic. I mean, you can just get started talking to prospects in 5 minutes.
Get in there, pay attention, subscribe to some RSS feeds, see what's going on, get your feet wet. They're not, what you can't do is go to the bookstore and buy a book about how to dominate MySpace and Facebook and get free traffic. You know what I mean? It's just too new and it changes too often. And you're not going to do that, but it depends what stage you're at. Like, we have a guy in our office that, it was an intern not that long ago working for free. And then, and I think now he's in our customer service department, you know, 10, 15 bucks an hour, something like that. And I just heard through the grapevine a little while ago, he had, from his Facebook page and his affiliate offers, he'd made like $65 one afternoon with free traffic from Facebook. Well, you know, for a guy that makes 10 bucks an hour, that's pretty damn cool. Mm. For us, where we've got $500,000 a month in overhead just for salaries, you know, we made $60 today, and, you know, it wasn't worth my time just saying that, you know. Just talking about it was not worth it, but it depends on kind of what level you're at. And, you know, if you've already got a big site, if you've already got a big list, if you're already kind of doing these things, you know, maybe it's time for you to start your own online community. But the idea of Web 2.0 being people talking to people on other people's websites, which really is what Web 2.0 is. And of course, if you ask 100 different people, you'll get 100 different answers, but that's really what Web 2.0 is people carrying on conversations with other people on other people's websites or just on websites in general. And it really should be your website. So if you've already got a big list, you've already got a big niche, you've already got a big product, you've already got a big company or whatever, you know, how can you get more people engaging and having a conversation with you, about your products, where you're participating and helping to drive the conversation? So maybe it's creating your own app, your own online community.
Well, I just read that, I think it was Ning.com, which allows you to create your own branded social network. I don't remember, 250,000 social networks they have now, I think.
Yeah. You know, I mean, pretty soon they'll be popping up another online community with friends and comments and automatic blogs and upload photos and videos and, you know, a forum. Those will be popping up as fast as blogs are created today. Mm. And by the way, I don't know if you've been following this, but they're saying that the big bloggers are starting to say, the people that follow this are starting to say that the conversation on the blogs are kind of going away. Because it used to be that you'd write a blog post that was kind of interesting or engaging, and you'd get a lot of comments. And now, and you still do, like when you put up a blog post or whatever, you get a lot of comments, but you know, you're saying it to your list and they're just coming there and they're not necessarily bloggers. In the normal blogosphere, the bloggers pay attention to each other, and it used to be that you'd write a good blog post and you'd get all these comments. Well, now you can have a great article, a great blog post, and you don't see as many comments. The comments are happening, but they're happening at Dig and StumbleUpon in a forum somewhere, and it's happening off the blog. Mm. In an online community somewhere. Mm. By the way, if you look at like what we've been doing in the video podcasting space, in the video blogging space, for example, at freelinereport.com, we put up a piece of software that was kind of like Ning, but it's called Crowdvine. So if you go to freeline.crowdvine.com, there's a social community, there's an online community of people interested in Web 2.0 and internet marketing. And it took me personally exactly like 7 minutes to set up that site. And it's neat. I mean, you can upload your pictures, you have friends, you have comments, you have a neat little tag cloud. People answer three questions like what's your title, what do you do for a living, where do you live, and what is your interest or whatever. And so it builds an automatic tag cloud so you can see at a glance in the right-hand column what are the characteristics of all the people in this community. It's pretty cool. Hmm.
That's fantastic.
And it's free, by the way. So, I mean, you know, to be able to for free set up an online community like that in 5 minutes, well, you know, the world's changing.
yeah, it is amazing. Free. And some of these, you can brand it yourself and do whatever you want.
So the first thing to pay attention to is online communities, to answer your question. The second thing is online video. You've got to recognize that, you know, pretty soon you'll have to have video just because it'll be the standard of business communication. The way things are done online won't be with static web pages. You'll have to have online video to be competitive. But right now, most websites still are not using video at all. And so if you will put some video on your site and understand how to do it, And by the way, you don't need to be like a professional, you know, studio quality, you know, motion picture kind of thing. But engaging with people in the multimedia format with, you know, human, we've always known on web pages from our eye tracking studies that people look at pictures on websites more than text, and people look at people's faces more than any other picture. And if you have a face that's on your website talking to people, it's just going to engage them so much more than any static text. And it doesn't have to be the highest quality video in the history of the world, but just figure out online video and get some video on your site. Whatever you're doing, you know, 2 and 3x conversion, twice as many, 3 times as many opt-ins, twice as many sales. You know, just as an example, on myweddingfavors.com, we have a video on the homepage where a lady comes out and talks to you. You know, one of those little 30-second things where they walk out in front of the webpage.
Yep.
You know, here's a thing that we did that cost us less than $1,000, but even more importantly, none of our own time. All we did was write the 30-second script, send it off to this company, pay less than $1,000, spend no more than the half hour it took to write the script. 4 days later, they send back a line of code. We put it on the homepage. We split test it so we know. Once we got to a statistically significant amount of data, that talking person engaging people on the site improved sales 9%. For a website that's already selling $500,000 or $600,000 a month, to be able to spend no time, less than $1,000, and improve sales 9% instantly is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and with all these applications online now, and there are even free applications you can download, but inexpensive things like Camtasia and ScreenFlow. I mean, you can sit down with a a MacBook laptop that's got a little camera in it and download a program for $100 and be immediately showing your PowerPoint on one side. It's got the video camera showing you talking. You can do simple editing and mixing, and it's unbelievable. It's amazing.
Yeah,
I mean, you press a button, it uploads right to YouTube.
Yeah, and by the way, I didn't want to say that was the point that I meant to make at first, is that you don't have to get paralyzed with, oh, I don't know how to do this. And you know what? It's not that hard. You can learn it, and it's inexpensive, and you don't have to create a motion picture. You just have to get some video on your site, and take heart that it doesn't have to be some studio CNN type of thing. If it's video and it's you and it's talking to people, even if it's bad, you'll do better, and you can always make it better. So just do it.
Yeah, you and I were just at a seminar recently here. You weren't there for this particular presentation, but I had these guys on stage who were, every day they do a video. And they do it from anywhere. I mean, some of their videos are up there. They're actually in the airport, you know, sitting over in the corner like, this is where I'm at right now. And so here's my video for the day, my little video podcast or whatever it is. And they make a lot of money. I mean, these guys are making millions of dollars a year. And it's not, you know, they're not in some high-end studio.
Right, right.
Okay, so social networks, kind of the whole social space, video. What else?
Well, those are a couple of the big things right
those
now.
Those are the keys, huh?
Yeah, those are a couple of big deals. I mean, that assumes that you're already, you know, are up to snuff and have got your a decent level of expertise in SEO, pay-per-click, affiliate marketing, web copywriting, emails and autoresponders, if you're already up to snuff on that. If not, those are the categories, and that's kind of what we were circling back to before, is that you have to be kind of thinking about what's next. But the key is, what do I have to learn to get to the next level? Well, sometimes it's how to hire people, or how not to get sued by your employees, or how to have an employee handbook, or what software, what technology, what do you do when your QuickBooks Pro starts to explode and you need something more expensive? All those things, what questions to ask. But the other thing is, what do you need to know to do what we do? And those are the things: SEO, pay-per-click, affiliate marketing, web copywriting, testing and tracking, conversion, and then online video and social media marketing. Those are the things that you have to know. And so you've got to have a plan in place to get good at all of those. And if you're only good at pay-per-click and you're not good at SEO, man, it's not that hard. I mean, the information is out there. Sometimes it's very inexpensive. And if you'll just resolve to not everything all at once, and not some $10,000 weekend seminar, but just over time, those are all the categories you want to know. And if you want to do internet marketing, that's the stuff you got to get good at, all of them.
Mm. All right, let's move on to talking about people. You and I have had a lot of discussions about people and the idea that if you don't have good people, it's going to be real hard to grow a good business. What are some of your thoughts about finding superstars and how important it is?
Really, in a nutshell, the trick to hiring a superstar is to let me say it this way, Evan. A superstar for you might not be a superstar somewhere else. Or, you know what I mean? It kind of depends on what your needs are and what the position is and things like that. And you might have a position, and if you don't really watch what we're about to talk about here, you might hire someone that could be perfectly great somewhere else, but they're not right for your organization, or they're not right for this position, and things like that. So the point is that the first step in this whole process of getting superstars for your organization is to be very methodical and very careful and very military, very disciplined about deciding what it is that you want. And so at our company, as an example, and I'll kind of run through it quickly, but we call it who, what, ticket. And the most important part is the who. Who is this person? We have a job to fill. Is it a programmer, a controller, a CFO, a designer, a copywriter, whatever it is? It's what is the who? And the who is this. What are the characteristics that we want that person to have? And that means the values and the behaviors. What are the values and the behaviors that we want this person to have? And this is more important than their resume. This is more important than what they're going to do every day. And it varies by position. A controller is going to have different values, behaviors. Is going to have different characteristics than a salesperson. So what we do is you get all the stakeholders together, the direct reports, the peers, the hiring manager, and we literally brainstorm, and that's what we're trying to do as a group, not just the owner, not just the hiring manager, just not the director of HR. You get all the people that matter, which are the direct reports of that person, the peers of that person, and the hiring manager, the manager of that person. You get them all together, and you brainstorm, and you say, hey, in addition to our core values, and by the way, if you have the core values of your company that you've kind of thought out and put down on paper, that's great, but if not, at least you know something about your own culture. And the idea is that in addition to our core values, what are the five main characteristics that we want this person to have for this job? And then you have everyone listed out, and then you go around and you vote, and you tally them up, and you see which got the most votes, and sometimes a few of them are obvious, and you argue about the last two. And as a group, you come to a consensus of what are the five characteristics that we want this person to have. And that's just cannot be overestimated, the importance of identifying that in advance. That's what's most important. Then, once you have that, then, as you well know, the idea is behavioral interviewing. And you can literally interview to determine whether the person that you're trying to hire, that you're interviewing, has those characteristics. It's possible. It's not even a question. If you use behavioral interviewing techniques, you can determine if job candidates have those particular characteristics. And if they do, and you hire someone that has exactly those five things that you're looking for, that's a big part of the battle.
Give me a quick example of doing a behavioral interview. Give me a couple of quick questions that someone that doesn't have as much experience as you interviewing could ask, approaches they could use.
Sure. So I'm not an expert on behavioral interviewing, but I'll tell you two things that are kind of the 80-20 that might be helpful. And first of all, I'll just say, go read Top Grading. Go read anything by Brad Smarts. There are people that are experts at behavioral interviewing, and some of the books aren't that thick. Top Grading's thick, but it's just because it has the four-hour interview questions in the back.
Yeah.
So go get these books and read them. But in a nutshell, and while we're here, the two things are, number one, an example is what you're trying to do. Let's say that you're hiring someone and you want them to be organized. Okay, you want to hire someone that's organized for a particular position. Some people might say that, I want everyone in my company to be organized. And there's been polls of CEOs that would not promote someone that had a messy desk. Well, if you have a very productive salesperson, they might not be that organized. It might not be in all cases that that's exactly what you want. But let's assume for the sake of argument that you've identified that one of the five key characteristics that you want this person to have to be a superstar for this position is you want them to be highly organized. And so behavioral interviewing is that you ask them a question like, You know, would you consider yourself a pretty organized question? And, you know, oh, sure, yeah, okay. Well, like on a scale of 1 to 10, how are you? And you want to try to set it up. So it's like, well, we're not going to hire anyone that's not super organized. How organized are you? You just kind of bring it up and, you know, in the interview and say, you know, are you a pretty organized person? You know, most people are going to say, yeah. And say, well, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, and then people are going to know, oh, I'm a 10 plus. They're going to say, oh, you know, I'm a 7 or an 8. And, you know, sometimes my desk sometimes looks messy, but I know where things are. Well, that is not a highly organized person. And if you ask it right, you're going to kind of know that right away. But here's what behavioral interviewing is. You say something like, would you consider yourself a pretty organized person? Oh, sure, yeah. Well, like on a scale of 10, how organized are you? Oh, I'm like a 9.5. I'm a 9.9. I'm a 10. Really? Well, give me some examples of why you think that, or give me some examples of how you're organized, or give me an example of do other people say that you're organized? Oh, give me some examples. And this is what behavioral interviewing is. It turns out that people that actually have that characteristic can think of a dozen examples off the top of their head of, like, for example, you know, well, I have all of my checks for every bill I've ever paid filed back to when I was in high school, and they're alphabetical. Or, you know, I'm the one that goes over to my friend's house and helps them organize their closets. Or I'm the one that drives everyone crazy because I just hate to have a file folder that doesn't have a label on it. Or, you know what I mean? People that have that characteristic will have a dozen stories off the top of their head about how they are that characteristic of behaviors that they've evidenced in the past. And they will just have it off the top of their head and they'll tell you those stories. Mm-hmm. And if they tell you those stories, you're going, wow, I guess you are pretty super, you know, organized. Or you're thinking, well, you can say you are, but, you know, if they don't have the stories off the top of their head, they're probably not. And so that's what behavioral interviewing is. The other thing that's real important in that is the idea of going through their history, and it's what they call in top grading the threat of reference check. And so you don't necessarily want to take the time to call every person that person's ever worked for, but in the interview you imply that you will. And of course you would call references and you do things like that, and it's just whether or not you actually choose to pick up the phone and get a hold of them. So it helps people just really kind of tell you the real deal about themselves. Like when you're going through someone's strengths and weaknesses, we all go through their strengths first and then say, well, we all have things we're working on. For example, I'm working on this. What are some of the things that you think you need to work on yourself? And if they say nothing, I'm perfect, they're probably not your guy. But, you know, people will list them out, and then you kind of let them list them and you go back. But then what happens is when you're going through the idea of the threat of reference check, it's a very important concept, because you'll say to someone, you want to go back through the people that they used to report to and find out what their boss that they used to work for would say good about them and would say bad about them. And the idea is to just simply say, what was his name? Okay, Jenny Smith. Great, you worked for Jenny Smith. And do you still have her contact information and stuff? Would we be able to get a hold of her? Okay, cool, great. When we talked to Jenny, what would she say is good about you, and what would she say that you need to work on? And so if they have the impression that you're going to be talking, actually following up and doing your reference checks, then they're much more likely to tell you in detail and truthfully what the person would say about them. And so you get much more informative, candid interviews by using that concept. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Well, I mean, in Brad Smart's example, someone who is an expert on behavioral interviewing, but I, you know, as you and I know, these interviewing ideas really pay off. The other thing I wanted to say on the who, what ticket is just that we talked about the importance of the who and really carefully defining that. The other thing is the what. After we figure out what the five characteristics are, then we as a group kind of define the what. And that's basically this. What is this person going to do every day, and how is it going to be measured? And putting that down in writing. And could you imagine that most people don't do that? I mean, if you had not just a job description for everyone in the company, but if you had a job description that for every person in the organization, and particularly the new hires and people that you're looking for, put down on paper before you ever get them, what is this person going to do every day, and how is it going to be measured? That would be profound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fantastic.
I hate to throw that out there, which is a really important idea, without saying the caveat that you have to be careful of job descriptions. One of the guys on our advisory board is Jerry Faust, who's an expert on organizational behavior. In fact, he invented computer-based learning, literally. But he helped, for example, Domino's grow from $30 million to $1.5 billion in 6 years and reorganized 6 or 7 times. One of the things he says is that the job descriptions are the things that the customers fall between. So when you go around and say, well, this person does this and this person does that, it makes it really easy for everyone to say, well, that's not my job. And so you have to be careful of that. But it is profound. If you can have for every person in your organization in writing on one page, I'm a big fan of one pages for everything. Like I said, I like to crystallize things down, and I like to get it on one page. And so a one page job description is great. And here's kind of the format that I recommend. Got this from Jerry. Across the top of it, it has her name and it has her title. And then across the top, it says, your number one job is to help us get and keep customers. Isn't that great? Mm. I mean, that's what Peter Drucker always said, that the only job of a business is to get customers. And putting that on everyone's job description at the very top, your number one job is to help us get and keep customers. And then on the left-hand side of the paper, you say, here's what you're going to do every day. Here's what you're responsible for. And then on the right-hand column, on the right-hand side of the page, it's how it's going to be measured. And that's great. People want to know. In fact, the best people want to know, they want to know that they're going to be accountable. And what that really means is if they bust their ass and they do a good job, that someone's going to notice, you know? And by the way, that is what people want. I don't know if we have a lot of time to go into it, but I can just tell you that one of the things that I've learned is that what people really want, you and I both know that people, if they like their job, they're not going to go across town, even if they can make a couple of grand more, you know? And at the same token, even if you're paying them a lot more and they hate it, they're not going to stay. And you're not going to keep the superstars. If you don't have a good culture, a good environment, then the only people you keep are the people that can't get a job anywhere else. So we can sort of know that. But here's, it turns out, what people want in work. It turns out that people want meaningful work. That's what people want. They want meaningful work. And what that means, it turns out, is two things. Is that people want to not be an automaton. The superstars, the good workers, the good employees, the people that care about their job and are trying to do a good job, which is most people, by the way. Most people don't go to work to see if they can be a lazy ass today. Most people that have a job, they want to pretty much do a good job, but they want meaningful work and they want to not be an automaton. People want to feel like they can use their judgment to solve the problems and do the job. People don't want to feel that they're just doing what they're told. And the second thing is people want to feel like if they do a good job, that it's going to be noticed, that there's accountability, so that the work is meaningful, that they're going to use their own judgment, their own smarts, their own intelligence, their own effort to solve the problems and get the work done and not just be told what to do. And then also that if they do a good job, there's accountability and that it's going to be noticed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of job descriptions, as you know. And as you're talking about this here, you're not talking the standard way. And I think that we're more on the same page than we're not, in that, you know, I have a little saying, which is, you know, one talent or one strength is much more valuable than 10 skills. And that what you're really looking for when you're trying to find someone who's really, really good at the core thing that you need done. And you may, I mean, it sounds like, you know, in your description here, as I'm listening through it, the top three of the five are the real key ones. The next two are kind of okay. You're not looking for a huge punch list of 47 things that they're going to have to be good at and all this other stuff that they're going to do. You're looking for someone that's a superstar in one core area, that they're really good at one thing and that takes responsibility for their life and that, you know, wants to make a difference and wants to, you know, take everything that's inside of them and make the business and customers' lives better.
Exactly. On the other hand, I mean, sometimes you do need to hire a controller. Sometimes you do need to hire a network administrator. And that person is, you know, we're not going to say, well, you're going to do this. You know, you're going to check the server, you know, every day. You're going to set up a thing to make sure that we don't have any downtime or whatever. It's more about saying, what are you responsible for? You're responsible for making sure that we have our monthly financials by the 5th of every month. And you're responsible for that. And so you know, another person is responsible for making sure that everyone's, you know, the HR person is responsible for certain things. So sometimes there are positions that have responsibilities, and to put down what those are, generally okay. I will say that, and that might be a little bit different from some of the ways that you guys do stuff, where you kind of, like, you know, throw them in there and let them kind of, you know, figure out where they shake out in the organization, because they just have great, you know, stick-to-itiveness or what you call a, what's the person at the top 1% that's the doer? What do you call the doer?
Driver.
The driver, a high driver, right? We call it a. That's often one of our characteristics of the five. We, you know, it's almost funny now. We always just put down "we it," just a whatever it takes kind of person. The person's never going to come back with an excuse. They're going to figure it out. Jerry Faust actually calls that a smart dog. So we want someone who's a smart dog. I don't know if you know how they actually test breeds of dogs to figure out who are the smart ones and which breeds are smarter than others.
I don't.
Well, it turns out you need a hungry dog and food and a barrier, and you put a barrier between the hungry dog and the food, and the little dumb dogs will kind of see a little fence and go, well, crap, I guess I can't find the food. I think I smell it, but I don't know what to do, and they'll sit there and not do it. The smart dogs will run 10 miles and climb the fence to get to the food. They will do whatever it takes to get there.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is, well, I mean, there's a lot to that. We could go in deep here, but there's a lot of psychological stuff that's going on here. You know, some people in their life, and I try to say this without any kind of judgment because, you know, there really isn't any, but some people in their lives, they just never learned how to take responsibility, or they don't want to. Some people never mm-hmm. learned how to be proactive, or they don't want to. Some people don't have an inner belief, I can deliver results, and maybe they wouldn't want to. And some do, and you want to find the ones that do.
You're right.
It's like so, it's so obvious in a way, you know. Some people want to be superstars, and you want to find those, not the ones you got to try to talk into being superstars.
Well, exactly. By the way, one of the things that that I put it, what goes at the bottom of this job description format that I like is at the bottom, the very last thing it says is you will always be responsible for the exercise of your good judgment. And that's the idea, is that you want everyone, and this, by the way, circles back to something we were talking about before, about how does an entrepreneur make his organization more productive? And this is it. You need a whole organization full of people that are not only driving things, but have good judgment and are figuring out problems themselves and are getting better and better and better at using better and better judgment and solving problems. And that's really it, because, you know, sometimes in the early days, you'll find very productive entrepreneurs that sort of do everything, and often the bottleneck for them is trying to get the organization to be able to sort of do it without them. And by the way, I think we talked earlier about before we started this call, Doug Tatum actually wrote a book called No Man's Land, and it talks about how companies grow from 20 million to 100 million. He calls it No Man's Land: what to do when you're too big to be small and too small to be big. And it turns out that's a very challenging time for companies because, you know, getting to 5 or 10 million in sales or whatever, that's okay. Well, now you got a real business going. You get $10 or $20 million. Okay, well, now you got a real company. But the next hurdle is getting to 100 million in sales is a big deal and is a problem. And a lot of companies literally grow themselves out of business. It's challenging going through no man's land. You need systems and you need expensive software and you need, you know, full-time CFOs and full-time HR departments and just stuff that you didn't used to have. Once you're a $100 million company, you have all that stuff. But going there and getting all this expensive stuff and going through no man's land is very challenging. Well, it turns out that in growing from 20 million in sales to 100 million in sales, really what it's all about fundamentally, the number one thing is that the organization has to get good at what the entrepreneur was good at. And so a lot of entrepreneurs limit themselves by doing too much. And so it's not just my tongue-in-cheek response that, well, don't do anything and, you know, have your organization do everything. Well, it's really true. And here's what I mean by an actual concrete, you know, test, an actual tool that you can use. So if someone comes to you, let's say that you're the guy at the top of the food chain, you're the CEO, or maybe you're the head of a department or whatever, but if someone comes to you, let's say you're the CEO, you're the business owner, you started the company, you're the founder, and you're still running the business as the CEO. So someone comes to you and asks you to decide something. Go ahead. They need your decision to move forward on something. And for a lot of entrepreneurs, they're like, well, what are you talking about? That happens all day, every day. And I would say, well, okay, well, that's the problem. But if you want the organization to grow fast, if you want the organization to get good at what you were good at, then you need to stop. Then you need to do this. If someone comes and they need your decision to move forward, go ahead and give them the decision, tell them what to do or whatever, and move the company forward, fine. But write that down. Notice that. Notice that your organization wasn't capable of making that decision without you.
Notice the decisions that your organization wasn't able to make without you.
Yeah. You know, because as you get bigger and you get more people and you get a few superstars and you get more and you get more senior level managers, you know, there's going to be less and less and less stuff that you actually have to decide to move it forward. You know, at Smart Marketing, for example, we launched 80 new products this year. I couldn't tell you what more than three of them were. You know, it's just, you know, as you get bigger, you just, you know, it's not my job. We have very competent people that do that. And, you know, I have other things that I'm doing. And so that will sort of happen naturally. But you need to realize that that's the deal. You want a whole organization filled with other people that are responsible for their areas of responsibility. And it's happening without you having to decide anything.
That's great. Let's talk just for a second about systems inside of a business. What have you learned about systemizing your business? And we can also touch, you know, a little bit. I include legal and finance and technology and so forth in this mm-hmm. in this world. But what have you learned in growing several businesses up past the multi-million dollar level?
You know, the companies that are big companies that do it well, that's what they have. They have, you know, the policy and procedure manuals And in the beginning, we're just sort of doing stuff. And then somebody says, hey, maybe we should write that down. Maybe we should draw some process flow maps. And usually sooner rather than later. A lot of companies have stuff. Every time something new comes in, they have to teach them what to do. And they never think to record that and, you know, start to build the training library. So,
You know what? How about this? You and I had a great conversation. I think we were over at John Reese's house and we were brainstorming about something. Mm-hmm. And you showed this little map and you showed how entrepreneurs are not interested in the finance, as an example. But they're interested in the entrepreneurial stuff and how that kind of hurts them. I'm kind of looking for the insights. My experience, Brad, is that a lot of business founders, entrepreneurs, those of us that are trying to grow a company fast, we look at this stuff as administration. And sometimes by overlooking it, it bites us in the ass,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Maybe it's back to the example you're talking about before. It's like, once you sort of know that, it's like, you know, in hindsight, it seems so obvious. But thinking back, you know, as we've grown fast, you know, you don't really see the importance of that stuff up front. And again, a lot of it comes down to, you know, one pagers. It's not necessarily about having this huge policy manual. It's about having one page that you can show to everyone in the whole company and say, this is our one page business plan. These are our core values. This is the way that we do this. This is the flow chart and trying to put it on one page so that people can look at it and understand it.
So in other words, keep your system simple, but build them.
The one thing I would say about systems that I guess I'd like to share is just the importance of the system of tracking, the idea of, you know, what gets measured gets done, the idea of, and not just a website analytic type of thing, but for the company, is the importance of figuring out what your key metrics are. And I would say that that's something that's fairly easy for most people to do and also is very actually rarely done and is actually really the most important. I mean, there's a lot of people that have companies that are doing millions of dollars, and I mean, they don't even have monthly financial statements. So, you know, it depends on what stage you're at. But if you've been doing that for a couple of years now, and you're doing 15 million or 8 million or 2 million or whatever it is, but that is one thing that I would say is that is easy to overlook. A lot of people, most people don't do, and really is fundamentally important. So in this whole idea of systematizing stuff is really paying attention to, and this is part of the do less, make more thing, is it's not about you really going and doing everything all day, every day, but as the owner, as the business owner, what are the reports that you're getting? What are the key metrics that you have in place? And what information do you get every day? What information do you get every week? And what information do you get every month? And maybe what information you get every quarter. So the idea of two things that I would say are great to systematize. And one is pay very careful attention and spend more time than you probably are, unless you've already done this at length. But figure out what are your key metrics and what reports are you going to get. And so usually it's five things. And you want to get those reports every month. And you want to have them be in trailing 12-month charts or 12-month moving averages so that you can remove the seasonality out of your charts. And hopefully we don't have to drill down on that too much. You do a great talk about the importance of charting and, you know, taking your five key things and just charting them by hand every day. And you'll just become psychic about your business with an understanding of what's going on. Mm. But figure out what your key metrics are, you know, what causes sales, operating expense as a percentage of sales, Turnover, whatever it is for you, figure out your five key things and chart those and use 12-month moving averages so that you remove the seasonality and you actually get a true picture. Otherwise, charts just lie to you. Sometimes they go up, sometimes they go down. But if you look at everything on a 12-month moving average, then you can see what's going on. Up is good, down is bad, and you can much quicker respond.
Yeah. I mean, I recommend that people just start out if they're not using charts. If you don't know how to use Excel, it can be daunting, but it actually takes 5 minutes to go in there and, you know, put the dates down the left-hand column and just start with number of leads you've gotten each day, number of sales you've gotten, dollar volume, how much money is deposited in the bank, and how much was taken out of the bank, how much did you spend that day. All this stuff hopefully can be gathered online in 5 or 10 minutes. You get the discipline of doing it every single day, and you really start to see your business. You get a feel for it. And it gets rid of the insecurity of not knowing how your business is doing, because I think that's one of the biggest problems in business is just not knowing how your business is doing until the end when you go bring the box of receipts into the accountant and say, what happened?
Sure. One great book I'd recommend, Eben, it's just kind of the top of my mind. Craig Kramer's was actually in my house today. He lives here in Atlanta. Great CEO, MIT undergrad, Stanford MBA. Grew a company from $30 million to $100 million in 3 years or 4 years in a flat market, a printing company, and then did the turnaround at Snapper Lawnmowers here in Georgia. He was a turnaround CEO for a while. So just a great CEO. And he has a book called CEO Tools. And it's just a whole book about specific tools you can use to be a better CEO. Great book.
That's fantastic. Well, Brad, thank you very much for taking the time to chat. I got several pages of notes here. And this is one of the most valuable interviews I've done. So thanks a lot.
Well, hey, it was great talking with you as usual, and glad to help.